The views and opinions expressed on Analyze This are entirely those of the on-air participants and do not reflect those of the station's board, management, staff, or underwriters.
And we're back here to analyze this, wrapping up a conversation with a good friend, Dr. Greg Guarnell. He works with the Virgin Islands. You work at UVI?
Yes.
You work at UVI, and they put together the plan, the Hazard Mitigation and Resilience Plan for the Virgin Islands. So, a question. Traditionally, governments established means for protecting its records, which in time became archives. Does the mitigation plan have a provision for VI records and archives, electronic and print?
We had discussions about this with a lot of stakeholders. Actually, we had extensive discussion with DPNR, some of its various groups, especially the library and the arts and the archive division. We also reached out to and had some discussion with some folks from the legislature to see, what they can do to help. So we do have some text in the documents, related to preservation of archive. But it turns out that Commissioner Oyo recently received a grant from the Department of Interior to speed up the process. So hopefully, a lot of what we were sort of proposing is going to become moot since the DPNR was able to secure that grant and really protect archives, because it's becoming imperative that a lot of the records be electronic. We saw it, after the hurricane. We're still living the consequences of that now. I was, for the project, I was trying to figure out when was the power plant built on both islands, but I couldn't access the data because, it was in paper form and some of it got damaged by the hurricane. So it's not just, when we're talking about archive and stuff like that, it's not just to sort of preserve, memories. It's actually very important because understanding the past helps us understanding the present and think about next steps. So I think, preserving archive is going to, and moving into electronic form, is going to really help the territory with making better decisions in the future, because we will have those data at our fingertips much faster. It goes beyond just, libraries and stuff like that. Even, the recent discussion about the taxi commission and the fact that they couldn't access their paper records, shows the value of moving things electronically. So we have, some discussion about trying to recommendation about the importance of moving things, more and more, moving away from paper and to electronic. The recent grant that DPNR was able to secure is really going to help the territory.
Dr. Greg Guarnell, looking forward to having you on the show for an entire hour. So we could break down some more data. Maybe one of these days we could get you in the studio in person, fly you over to find a reason for UVI to fly you over to St. Croix so you could duck into the studio and we could have a conversation. Because I remember our first conversation, we were talking about where you're originally from, right? Was it Guadeloupe, yeah. Martinique, or
Saint-Louis? Martinique.
Martinique. Yes. Martinique. That's Fort de France, right? Down there, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So, I'm a geography buff, and you just spoke about geology and all that. So things like that, I like to talk about it, and I think the audience likes to talk about it well. So we could work on that. Let Judy know to set that up.
Okay, I will talk to her.
Thank you very much, sir.
And
appreciate
thank you for the invite.
Nah, man, thank you so for the short notice and allowing us to break this thing down even more and educating me about the geology and all the, what's it, geophysical, right? That's the term?
Yeah.
Geophysical, yeah. We the article I read last week with New York and all that stuff, so I appreciate that. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, my pleasure. Have a nice day.
Okay, good. You got it. That's Dr. Greg Guarnell from UVI. They work on the Hazard Mitigation and Resilience Plan. Before we bring in Dr. Tull, let me do my homework here. Today's the last day of May, so we're looking for that Take 12, that June edition of Take 12. My partner, Danny Challenger, and Sierra Singh, grace to cover the May edition. So we're looking forward to that June edition. Sharon Rosario gonna hook me up. Sharon Barnes gonna hook me up. PBS News Hour at 7, Nature at 8, where they explore the mysteries of wild pandas whose counterparts in captivity have a more gentle image. And then we have another edition of Nova at 9, and they investigate the 2021 crash of the Ever Given container ship in the Suez Canal. Secrets of the Dead comes on at 10. And then Amancor and Company at 11. The Secrets of the Dead, they're going to investigate the identity of a captain of a mystery ship that turned away from the Titanic. Okay, so News Hour at 9, 2 hours. No, yeah, News Hour at 9. Excuse me, News Hour at 7. Nature at 8. Nova at 9. Secrets of the Dead at 10. And we got some COVID numbers, so I can wait until the end of the show to drop that data. The Virgin Islands updated the weekly COVID activity here in the Virgin Islands. So we're going to transition now to a study on disaster patterns and healthcare. We got Dr. Eugene Tull joining us on the line. Good morning, Doc. How are you? Good morning, Dr. Tull. You there or we lost him? Sometimes whenever people call in on that a particular line, it'll take a while. There we go. Good morning, Dr. Tull. You there? I guess not. Yeah, so looking forward, probably we could get that one hook up again and see if we could get Dr. Tong to call in. But I want to thank both Daryl Jashin and Dr. Greg Wannell for joining us in hour number one and start the show. And it's the start of hour number two. You know something? Let me do the COVID 19 weekly update. Public health makes the numbers available now. Of course, Monday was Memorial Day, so they had the update yesterday. 508,637 total tests, 25,122 positives. Now, this is from March of 2013. Okay, 483,515 negatives. Okay, most recent data. We had a 10% positivity rate, so we got to keep an eye on that, okay? 369 negatives out of 405 total tests. Okay, so 369 divided into 405, 9.11%. Got 33 actives in the territory, 15 on St. Croix, 17 on St. Thomas, 1 on St. John. And of the 36 tests actives during the week, 13 on St. Croix, 22 on St. Thomas, and 1 on Love City. I believe we have Dr. Tull on the line. Good morning, Dr. Tull. How are you? Good morning, sir. I know he's there because I could hear the thing. It looks like he's not hearing us. Good morning, Dr. Tull. Eugene Tull, how are you?
Hi, good morning. I'm well, thank you.
Okay, good. Thanks for joining us this morning. Glad to have you on.
Well, it's good to be here. And I'm on. Am I live now?
Yeah, you're live. We can hear
wonderful.
You. Introduce.
Well, good morning to everybody out there in our radio land, all the Virgin Islanders who are listening.
Mm-hmm. Introduce yourself to the listening audience.
Okay, great. So my name is Eugene Tull. I am a doctor of public health. I specialize in research and intervention, behavioral intervention, to prevent disease. And I have worked in a variety of capacities.
Give us your background.
Great. I've worked in a variety of capacities. I've worked at the University of Pittsburgh as a professor in the School of Public Health. I have done a stint working for the Virgin Islands government as a territorial epidemiologist back in the days of pandemic influenza. and when we had the outbreaks with dengue fever. And now I am operating my own research organization that I funded. I founded about in 2013 to do research to understand the root causes of health problems that we face in the Virgin Islands and elsewhere in the Caribbean.
Tell us where you're from, man. Tell us you're a proud Virgin Islander. Tell us all that good stuff.
So I grew up in the Virgin Islands, and this what I'm going to talk about today is really an extension of all the work that I've been doing over the years to try to generate information that could be useful to help the people of the Virgin Islands improve their overall health long term, not just now, but well into the future.
What prompted this?
Well, you know, we had the disaster caused by Irma and Maria in 2017, and the federal government. What prompted specifically what I'm going to talk about today? The federal government put a lot of money, or at least gave a lot of money, for infrastructure development, recovery, and ways to try to develop ways to make the Virgin Islands more resilient in terms of its infrastructure, health systems, and the like. And so as part of that effort, the National Institutes of Health, the premier research funding organization in the world, decided they want to be a part of the process. So they provided funds for people to write grants and projects to identify key factors that might influence resiliency, not in the infrastructure or systems, but actually in the people. So what can you find out about disasters and how it affects the people that can allow you to be able to prevent the sort of consequences that people have as a result of having to deal with the stresses of disaster? And so as a researcher and having created a research organization in the Virgin Islands, what I wanted to do was to respond to that. And so I wrote a grant that specifically looked at trying to identify the core factors that are influencing disaster-related consequences among Virgin Islanders. And so I was funded. I think I was the only organization that got funds, research funds, from the Virgin Islands. I don't know if anybody else applied, but most of the funds went to Puerto Rico. Nevertheless, I got the project. We initiated the project. We completed the project, and now I have some preliminary findings that I would like to present to the public. Things I think the public ought to know, and how we can move forward.
Well, proceed. Go right ahead. What jumped out at you in the aftermath of what we dealt with the hurricanes?
Well, excuse me. Well, one of the big challenges that we have here in the Virgin Islands is that we tend to be a more reactive type of community. So prevention isn't really, from what I've seen, from my experiences, prevention isn't really at the forefront of what we do. And so what happens is that when the disaster strike, people experience a lot of problems, but the response is for them to call a number or, you know, reach out to a hotline. Not everybody wants to do that. And so I found that a little challenging, because I knew there were people who were having long-term issues from the disaster and disasters previous. And so I wanted to develop a strategy for educating, training people that will help them to not have the problems that might occur if a disaster happens. And so that really prompted my interest in developing this study.
And in the initial findings of the study, what jumped out at you?
well, several things were pretty much consistent with some other work I had done in the Virgin Islands before. And I'll just really just summarize them really quickly. So one of the things that really popped out was that there were certain people who use a certain type of coping strategy that were more likely than others to experience high levels of stress. Okay? Mm-hmm. So these are people who use what we call behavioral disengagement types of coping. So they would tend to, situation pops up, give up in trying to deal with the situation. Say, well, I can't deal with that. You know, I leave that alone. But the stressor is still there. And so individuals who exhibit and who use that type of strategy, we found out had higher levels of disaster stress. Second point is that when you experience high levels of disaster stress here, you're more likely than not to have consequences, health-related consequences of disaster stress. And so just stress that's chronic will eventually lead to consequences like diabetes and heart disease. Right? This is well known. And so what we found in the study was that there were actually people who were using this type of strategy I talked about, coping, this behavioral engagement coping, that were manifesting preliminary signs that they were on their way to having these long-term consequences. So that jumped out at me, too. The other thing was that that we were trying to find in this particular study was that we had looked at in another study in the Virgin Islands was the relationship that exists between spirituality and disaster stress and religiosity and disaster stress. What we found was that in an earlier study in the Virgin Islands, we found that people who had scored low in spirituality tended to be the ones who were more affected by the consequences of disasters or stress. And so that was replicated in this study. So the people who scored lower in spirituality were the ones who are more likely to experience the long-term consequences of disaster stress.
Okay. that's interesting. What we're going to do, we're going to take a break and we're going to come back. We're going to look at our demographics. I'm sure you got some demographic data there, right? When analyzing the Virgin Islands?
Well, when we look at the study was specifically in adults.
Oh, adults. Okay, good. Okay, we'll take a break. We'll come back. I will pick up the discussion. We got Dr. Eugene Toe joining us here on Analysis this morning. We'll take a break. Be back right after this.
Business opportunities at Banker St. Croix. Banker St. Croix offers deposit banking products, business online platforms, and commercial loans. Our SBA lending department offers financing options and access to capital for businesses. Banker St. Croix has two locations, one in Gallows Bay, 340-773-8500, and Peters Rest, 340-713-8500. BankerSt.Croix.com. Banker St. Croix is an equal housing lender.
These days, people go to great lengths to shed the stress of daily life. There's acupuncture, deep tissue massage, meditation, yoga. At All Things Considered, we offer our own type of healing, invigorating news stories that span the rainbow of human experience. Nourish your mind and escape from the ordinary. Weekdays on All Things Considered from NPR News.
From 5 to 8 p.m., right here on WTJX FM 93.1.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we are not afraid to stand up to the high and mighty like Jeff Bezos.
He had that big cowboy hat on. He looked like a shrink ray had hit Garth Brooks.
I'm Peter Sagal. Join me as we speak truth to power, at least until power agrees to buy us out, on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturdays at 1 p.m. and Sundays at 2 p.m. right here on WTJX FM 93.1, your NPR station in the Virgin Islands.
All of us want to know what's going on, but only some of us want to know the why. That's where we come in. 1A is a place for the curious. Daily conversations for those looking to make sense of our world. I'm Jen White. I hope you'll join me next time for 1A.
Catch 1A at its new time, weekdays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on WTJX FM 93.1.
And we're back here on Analysis, and we're having a discussion with Dr. Eugene Tull. He conducted a study on disaster patterns and healthcare here in the Virgin Islands. Good morning again, Dr. Tull.
Hi, good morning.
Dr. Tull, define behavioral science for those who are listening.
Behavioral science?
Yeah, in terms of what you're studying behavior. Right? You're studying behavior in terms of how people were reacting in the aftermath of the storms and all that. So from a definition standpoint, from a perspective, how you were looking at things to break down the data.
So let's everybody gets on the same level here. All right, so there is behavioral science in the sense of the understanding of how people relate to the environment.
To the environment, correct. Yeah.
And so forth.
And then the behavioral science that you were dealing with, which was trauma and crisis.
And then there is health behavior, which is what I am involved in,
mm-hmm.
which is trying to understand how behavior is influenced by higher level factors like culture, environment, and then how the behavior in turn influences physiological and biological outcomes, like your blood pressure or the size of your waist, for example, and then how that in turn relates to things like insulin resistance and diabetes and cardiovascular disease. So the behavioral part is interwoven in a holistic model of health, and that's the approach that I take.
What was the number of people that you looked at to arrive at your conclusion?
A convenient sample in this one. So we looked at about 160-170 people, and we recruited them in such a way that they were representing neighborhoods across St. Croix and across St. Thomas. So in previous studies, I've done random samples, taking populations I ran them from different communities. But in this one, given the amount of money we had to do the study, small amount of money, we used a convenient sample, and then we recruited people from different places so that they would represent the neighborhoods across the territory.
Your sample size, you said, was about 100?
No, the sample size was about 170 people.
170 or 107?
Yeah, about 170, yes.
170, okay. Territory-wide?
Correct.
Okay. You could break that down a little bit more. Include St. John?
No, we didn't. We didn't do any recruitment on St. John. So it was St. Croix, St. Thomas.
St. Croix, St. Thomas, okay.
Roughly about 100 on St. Croix and about 70 on St. Thomas.
How you went about recruiting?
Well, again, the recruitment was what we call a convenience sample type of recruitment. So we recruited from people who worked at health centers, we recruited from churches, we recruited from just in general people who were walking around, milling around, for example, at a Sunny Isle, people over who are visiting Frederick Health Center, for example, or we were in at the mall in St. Thomas and a few other places. So just a general recruitment for what we call a convenience sample.
Okay. Now, the healthcare data, talk a little bit about that, that came out of the, right, out of the sample.
Okay. All right, so let's just... So, this is not a study about healthcare.
Excuse me?
So this is a public health-related study.
Public
so
health, okay, good.
So this study is not looking at what happens with people with respect to care, not this one.
Mm-hmm.
But what? How do you identify people who are at risk and then keep them from getting the problem? So it's about prevention, not about care.
Okay.
So I have a study I did, ancillary studies that looked at care linking the disaster and the COVID outbreak, and I could talk about that another time, but there's no specific data on health care in this study.
The sample size of 70 out of St. Thomas. Break that down for me, if you will.
I don't have the specific neighborhoods right at my disposal right now. That's on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no one neighborhood in particular that was overly represented. The people were just from spaced out. They lived in different places. And that's what we wanted to have, that there would be people from all over the island. So I don't have the specific numbers on each person available to me right now.
The findings, though, when you analyze this data, where did it lead you in terms of possible areas that we could use from a public health standpoint with the unfortunate reality that, you know, it might, what we experience might happen again, and how we could apply the data to help us deal with the adverse realities that come with disasters?
Okay, that's a very good question. All right, so number one, here's what we found that would be helpful. We found that the long-term complications associated with disaster stress were primarily driven by individual types of stressors, so things that happen to people on an individual level. The short-term outcomes like mental health issues and things that people have relative to their jobs and so forth were driven primarily by issues relating to interfamily conflicts and interpersonal relationships arising out of the disaster. So those areas could be specifically targeted, for example, within the context of where people work. You know, information could be provided. Things could be set up to help people, even before, right after disaster, for example, to deal with these sort of issues according to the different categories. Another important thing is that we're able to identify, from this study, we're able to identify those specific people who need to have intervention now so that when disaster strikes, they won't be adversely affected by the long-term consequences and by the stress. Because we know how to identify, from this study, we know how to identify those people who are more likely to have problems when the disaster strikes. And so if you identify them now, you get them into some training programs to help them improve their coping strategies, then when disaster strikes, they're less likely to be impacted. So that part would be good for prevention. The other thing that came out of the study is that we're able to identify the specific types of coping mechanisms that people with high levels of spirituality used to protect them against the long-term effects of stress.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, I did say that when you look at spirituality, people with low levels of spirituality were the ones more likely to be impacted by the stressful situations that arise from disasters. And so my question was, what protects the people with high levels of spirituality? And so we're able to identify the specific coping mechanisms that those people use that protect them from long-term consequences. So if you're able now to identify those people who are more likely to be impacted, those are low levels of spirituality, those who use certain types of coping, and then retrain them in how to use these other types of coping strategies that protect the other people, then they would be less likely to be impacted when the disaster strikes. So you have, from this data, the capacity to actually train people now to keep them from having the problems later.
The findings from this data, the Department of Public Health has them?
I was working with a group there, and I provide them with some of the data that we did produce from this study, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that you really have to understand, and this is just my perspective of interacting with the department, working there and so forth over the years. the agenda of the department is driven more by a medical model overall than a public health model. So what might happen is that there might be more of an emphasis on how do we take care of people once a disaster strikes. Do we have the capacity to help them and so forth and so on? So providing information on the preventive side may not necessarily go very far. And so, we presented the information, but I don't know how far that will go because the model is a little different.
Break down that distinction, medical versus public health.
On a medical model, which really has driven our health-related discussion forever here in the Bird Johnson. On a medical model, what you're thinking about is how do we provide services to people who are in need of care? So it's like disease and cure. It's like we all grew up, we get a cut. A mother or a parent or guardian, whatever, puts a bandage on the cut, we're good to go. So we have a problem, it gets fixed, right? And so this is the model that drives a lot of thinking here in the Virgin Islands. On the prevention model, the results that you get are not going to be imminent. They're not going to be right now. They're further down the line. And so what you have to do then is to put in place a system that will allow you to continuously reinforce whatever intervention that you're trying to do to help ensure that over the long term, the consequences that you're trying to prevent will more than likely be prevented. So take, for example, Department of Health. Whenever there's changes in administration, even if there were some preventive action going on, that might change based on who now becomes leader of whatever area or whatever it is. And so the continuity that's necessary for prevention is not there because prevention requires institutionalizing whatever effort you make. Right? So you have to institutionalize that intervention so that it continues over and over and over and over again, regardless of who's in charge of the system and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what prevention is really all about, institutionalizing interventions.
When you looked at the demographics in this sample, even if it wasn't a large sample, you arrived at the conclusion that embracing spirituality had those coping better with the disaster, right? That was your findings?
Well, let me just regress for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Let's define spirituality, okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right, so spirituality, in terms of how we do the research, is defined differently from religiosity. Okay, so religiosity, for example, is going to church, how frequently you engage in personal devotions, how much you express the beliefs of your religion, how much you say that the religion is incorporated into your daily life. That is religiousness, okay? Spirituality is a more broader concept. So embracing things like hope, your sense of connection to others. If you have a higher power, the sense of connection you have with the higher power. Your sense of contentment.
Mm-hmm.
So these are spiritual things, and they're embedded in all peoples. And whether you go to church, you don't go to church, you have some level of spirituality. And the people high level of spirituality who don't attend religious events.
But we're talking about spirituality, and how it impacts you. In times of high stress.
Yes. And so what we measured was, we measured spiritual along three levels, right? So one was connectedness, contentedness, and connection, contentment, and hope.
Mm-hmm.
So these three levels, okay? And so people who were in the score, we use a questionnaire. So people scored higher in the groupings of all three, we would say had high levels of spirituality. And so people who expressed lower levels of those things were the ones who were more likely to be impacted by the consequences of stress. They were more likely. Now, spirituality, and I need to make another clear point. Spirituality does not stop you from being stressed.
Correct. That's a good point. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It protects you from the effects of stress.
Yeah, and it allows you to cope with a stressful situation.
Exactly. But, it allows you to cope effectively with stress.
Yeah, but it's like the pandemic. The vaccine don't protect you. It don't stop you from getting infected. It allows for you to deal with it. Well, that's the thinking, right? Of course, you know, everybody has their own.
Correct.
Everybody has their own belief.
Similar
everybody has their own belief, but that's how it's articulated. What we're gonna do? We're gonna take a break. We come back, wrap up the conversation with Dr. Eugene Tull, and talk about. I wanted to talk about the grant process as well, how you go about, you know, getting the government to actually consider and then buy into what you're seeking support for. We'll take a break, and we'll be back right after this.
PBS NewsHour has a rich legacy of in-depth reporting and strong storytelling.
Only four people have sat in that chair before us, and the enormity of this moment is not lost on me. People turn to us because they know they can hear from trusted sources of information and news.
That won't change a bit, even as the faces behind the desk change.
Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz.
Weekdays at 7 p.m. on WTJX TV, Channel 12.
Listening to the wings of a monarch butterfly. What a magical thought.
They arrive here on the Day of the Dead, which we celebrate here in Mexico. And a lot of the indigenous people believe that it's the souls of their ancestors that are returning. You know? And it's very spiritual.
That's On Point with me, Meghna Chakrabarty.
Weekdays at 1 p.m. on WTJX FM 93.1.
I'm Deepa Fernandez from Public Radio's Midday News magazine, Here and Now. We'll bring you all the news that happens between the morning headlines and the afternoon wrap-up, plus conversations with authors and artists, stories that affect you, maybe a story about you. So please join us for Public Radio's Midday News magazine, Here and Now.
Weekday afternoons from 3 to 5 p.m. right here on WTJX FM 93.1.
Hi, I'm Peter Sagal. You spent the week listening to the news. Don't you think you deserve to show off what you've learned on Wait, Wait, We Give You a Chance to Impress Your Friends with your knowledge of international incidents, political gaffes, and the latest advancement in German nudists? You'll be the life of the party or the death. Either way, you'll make an impression and you can thank Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturdays at 1 p.m. and Sundays at 2 p.m. right here on WTJX FM 93.1, your NPR station in the Virgin Islands.
And we're back here, analyze this, having a discussion with our Dr. Eugene Tull as we look at, study the disaster patterns and healthcare and the relation. Good morning once again, Dr. Tull.
Good morning.
Morning. So let's go back to submitting the grant proposal. How does that work? Explain that to the audience.
Are you referring to the actual proposal I submitted?
The actual proposal that you submitted, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So how that works is that the National Institutes of Health or any government agency issues a request for proposals, and they sort of outline their interest areas that they want interest in, and so. And there's a framework for how you write a proposal that's already set up, you know, by the agency or agencies who are making the request.
Mm-hmm.
And so my standpoint, I have a lot of experience writing research grants. So I was able to set it up in a way that it would be reviewed favorably. Because one of the things that you need to have when you're going after grants, like at the NIH, you need to have some sort of preliminary data to suggest that what you're talking about has validity or what we call biologic plausibility. Okay? So the proposal I made was based on the hypotheses that I proposed to examine and test in the research grant. That's what you do. You propose some hypotheses, and then you say how you're going to test them. And so those hypotheses were based on preliminary studies I had already done in the Virgin Islands and elsewhere in the Caribbean. So I had an idea of what I might find, and I just said, this is how I'm going to prove prove what I'm suggesting is the case. And so that's how you formulate your proposal and you submit it. But it comes out of the money being set up there for you to apply for, and then you applying specifically to that target area that they're requesting.
How long did it take for this one to come together?
To write this proposal, it took me about 3 months.
And the response from this is for the Department of Health or NIH?
No. This is the NIH. The Department of Health doesn't fund these types of projects. So I have gotten some projects funded by the Department of Health, but those are through monies received. Those are secondary funding through monies received that they receive from the federal government for a particular area.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would set up a similar type of thing where, you know, they request a proposal and you and you apply for it based on the set of criteria that they want you to address. But that's not something that's done here by the local government, which is sort of problematic for people who do research. Because one of the things I've been doing research in the Virgin Islands for a long time, when I worked at the University of Pittsburgh, and it's very difficult to get money to do research in the Virgin Islands for two levels. One, it's a small population. And then secondly, there tends to be a bias when projects go in for review by other, for peer review, because the Virgin Islands are so different that the question people ask is, why do you want to do it there? What relevance does it have to the continental U.S.? And so you have to have, to get funding from national entities like the NIH, the project that you propose has to have some relevance to the larger U.S. as a whole. So specific things that relate to the Virgin Islands hardly would ever get funded for research, simply because it's such a different population.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things I've always said. The Virgin Islands needs its own science because it's different. And not everything that's done in the U.S. as far as projects and interventions is really applicable to the Virgin Islands, particularly when it relates to behavioral-related issues. Because people behave differently here in the Virgin Islands than they do in the continental U.S.
Well, you know, one thing I would like for us to study, looking back at what we experienced with the pandemic, was when the vaccine became available to the public,
yes.
We had mainlanders who were flying down here to get access to the vaccine.
Correct, because it was easier to get it here.
Yeah, and as a result, we became a vaccine destination, right?
And, yes, that's
true. No, and we've talked about medical tourism for the longest, right? And the vaccine kind of validated in a roundabout way that there is some validity to that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree 100%. In fact, I mean, this is a little off the beaten path.
I understand that, but we're talking about studies. So as a result, right, looking back at that experience, isn't that something that maybe we could look at? Because you just mentioned, right, about a dichotomy with respect to how people look at the Virgin Islands as opposed to continental U.S. and the disparity in population size, which is real, right? But it actually plays a part in accessing resources and money,
correct.
Right? So,
correct.
So looking at what we experience, where they learn the game, right? In other words, no, let me put it this way: they were gaming the system because they were aware of the fact that vaccines were made available on a daily basis, and the Department of Health was not in the business of wasting vaccines if there were those who were willing to take it. Right, and then as a result of that, it was a cyclical process where if you got one shot, you had to take another one in either 2 weeks or 3 weeks, right? So there was enough that there were more than enough dynamics there involved that we accumulated enough data to justify the need for a grant to study what actually took place there.
That's a good point. I mean, that's something that probably could be looked at.
Yeah. I don't want us to rule it out, but we got to look at ways to study human behavior. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, that would be something that would be very interesting in terms of looking at. But there are other. I mean, I did some work on the on the pandemic as well. And similar to this project, I recruited like 100 more people and did an assessment of how the pandemic influence, for example, how I'm thinking about vaccine acceptance and stuff like that. And so behaviors are very, very interesting and often very differently between here and the continental U.S. Just off the top, for example, one of the things that I found with the pandemic and vaccines was that here, for example, people would be more likely to say that I'm going to take the vaccine if they saw, this is what they said, if they saw more engagement from the Department of Health in the community, for example. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so not just how the individual who is responding to the issue, it's not only important for to understand how the person who is offered the vaccine relates to the vaccine itself, but also how they relate to the person who's who and the entity that's going to provide them with the vaccine. That's also important. So that sort of thing you could look at in terms of, like, you know, the whole picture of who's coming down and why they're coming down and that kind of stuff to get vaccines and so forth.
And another dynamic is that, you know, we had significant population displacement from between the two most recent censuses, which was 2010 and 2020. But in particular, our displacement actually took place in the latter part of the decade, right? The early on in 2012, obviously with Hovensa closing, that impacted us. But the hurricanes in particular, right, in 2017 impacted population even more so. And then, of course, it took another hit with the pandemic. So in terms of a public health study, again, looking at how that impacted, you know, us as a territory, and if in fact the data reflected from a per capita standpoint, ratios, if it truly reflected what percentage of the population took the vaccine, right? Because they were using the 2010 numbers as the denominator when in fact they should have been using the 2020 numbers. So that's another thing that we could look at.
That's another issue. And another issue that you look at as well is that this is the last 40, 50 years. Every year you got a lot of young people, they graduate, they go up to the States and never come back.
Never come back. Yeah, man. Yeah. That's another unquestioned dynamic.
Yes, there's a change in terms of the makeup of the Virgin Islands from that standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And who and the people who are left, what are they more likely to do? Because, you know, across every population, the early adopters, late adopters, and so forth. And so is it in the Virgin Islands, for example, we just have an overwhelming number of late adopters because a lot of our early adopters have left and gone off to the States? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that would influence vaccine acceptance as well. So once you understand these sort of things, then you might need to put in place strategies to address the issues that affect those people.
And finally, because, you know, we've been following the COVID-19 activity from the inception of this show, which is a little over 3 years ago, compared to the other insular possessions, you know, our data numbers is very, very, I would say, low. We're at like 2/3 from a vaccination level compared to American Samoa, Guam, Northern Mariana Islands. And I don't like to include Puerto Rico for obvious reasons because we're talking 3 to 4 million people down there and 100,000 here and the other smaller. So I like to compare our numbers to Guam and CNMI and American Samoa. So that's something else we can look at as well. Dr. Tull, it was nice talking to you this morning, man.
Oh, can I say one last thing?
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
One of the things that I'm trying to do as far as my efforts, as far as intervention and health promotion, is I'm putting together some pages on YouTube to promote some things I think are important as far as the future health of the Virgin Islands. So I don't get a lot of people coming to my page from the Virgin Islands. They come from the U.S. So if people out there are listening, you can check out my page. It's Doc Carib Backyard Life on Facebook. A lot of people use Facebook. So Doc Carib Backyard Life. Check out my page. I put a lot of stuff out there about Caribbean-related things and backyard stuff that we can do to improve our health.
So what you said, Doc Carib?
Yeah, D-O-C, Doc Carib, C-R-I-B,
mm-hmm.
Backyard Life.
Backyard Life.
Yes.
Okay, good. All righty.
All right, thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you very much, Dr. Tom.
For the discussion as well.
Okay, good. Well, that's what we do here. You know, we like to, you know, look at numbers and apply them, but in a relative sense, not just raw numbers alone, because you got to look at things contextually. You know what I'm saying?
Correct.
You can't just look at volume. Volume don't really speak to everything. It lets you. That's a raw number. Then you got to apply it the right way. Thank you very much, Dr. Tull. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. Have a great day. That's everybody. Bye bye.
Bye bye. That's Dr. Eugene Tull, and he did a study with respect to behavior in the aftermath of disasters and all that stuff. And that's the type of thing that I think we don't, you know, embrace enough. I mean, we try to do it here on this show. You know, we got to look at behavior, man. Just can't look at numbers, raw numbers and all that stuff. The numbers never lie, right? But they don't tell the whole story. And that's something that I think, you know, we try to convey here and analyze this and we're looking at the data. Okay? So, as it stands right now, looking at that COVID number there, we saw where the positivity rate for the last week was at 9%. It's understandable, you know. We're dealing with it was a month ago, the carnival. But we had graduations, and when you got graduation, you got people can congregating, coming together, and, you know, the likelihood, you know, that going to happen. And people traveling, too. You know, check. What have you. So hopefully, we could do that. Check this out for the rest of the week. Tomorrow, we got the Women's Coalition of St. Croix joining us. They got a 39th annual women's race. I've been seeing that ad on TV. June 4th, I believe that it is. So that's Sunday, right? So they're going to be on tomorrow in hour number one. And then we have a visiting artist for the month, Amy Gibbs, is going to be joining us from 9 to 10. And then we got a power hour on Friday. Good friend Kyle Fleming gonna be joining me here in the studio, and then in hour number two, Caribbean Dance gonna be joining us. We gonna have an Arts Thursday and an Arts Friday as well. Caribbean Dance, they're gonna be joining us in hour number two. So Marisol, make a note of that. Okay, thanks everyone for listening. Be good, be safe. Thank you, Glenn. And thanks to people over at Mountain Top and everyone here in the building. Talk to you tomorrow. Bye bye.
The views and opinions expressed on Analyze This are entirely those of the on-air participants and do not reflect those of the station's board, management, staff, or underwriters.
If it's happening around the world...
NPR's Frank Langfitt is in London covering this one. Hey, Frank.
Good morning.
Cuba is experiencing its biggest anti-government protests.
If it's happening here at home...
On a blistering hot day in Twin Falls, Idaho...
On the northeast border of Mississippi, where the river nourishes rich and green.
Morning Edition from NPR News will take you there, wherever the story is. Listen every weekday.
From 6 to 8 a.m. here on WTJX FM 93.1.
Ability Radio is a program brought to you by the Disability Rights Center of the Virgin Islands to promote a more inclusive Virgin Islands. Ability Radio brings you information on healthcare, art, culture, education, and current affairs, where we engage in lively discussions with guests locally and abroad. Join us every Saturday morning at 11:30 a.m. on WTJX-FM